Neighborhood Morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019. We begin with the news section. Power plays. Despite lingering tensions over Crooked Creek, Wake commissioners set their 2019 priorities. Earlier this month, in its first meeting since two new members were sworn in, a bitterly divided Wake County Board of Commissioners voted 4-3 to declare a surplus a former golf course that it acquired for $4 million just last year for parkland and put it up for sale. The majority, Greg Ford, Jessica Holmes, James West, and newcomer Vicki Adamson, argued that they were correcting the previous board's mistake and that developing a park in Crooked Creek wasn't fiscally responsible, given the county's other needs, such as school and affordable housing. On the other side were Sig Hutchinson and Matt Calabria, who voted for the park last year, and newcomer Susan Evans, who seemed annoyed at having to deal with something so fraught so soon. The park money, Hutchinson and Calabria pointed out, came from a separate pot than school funding. And Hutchinson chastised the anti-park camp for doing the bidding of political benefactors whose largesse helped Addison get elected. Tensions haven't cooled in the 2 weeks since. That will be a park one day, says David Carter, a former Wake County Parks director who has advocated for the Crooked Creek Park. This isn't to go quietly into the night. We're expanding our footprint when it comes to letting people know and making sure they understand what the commissioners have done. So nope, not going to go away. The backlash on social media and in Ford, Holmes, West, and Adams' inboxes got so bad that last week they released a 13-page letter defending their vote and sharply criticizing the commissioners who supported the purchase, saying the county should not be in the business of failed golf course bailouts. They have questioned the potential influence of campaign donors who support public education, while remaining silent on the potential influence of their own donors who are property owners, land developers, real estate agents, and others with potential economic interests in Crooked Creek, or in the precedent it sets for taxpayers buying failed private projects. They started it, Hutchinson retorts. I have just responded to what they started, and it started off back when they came out with a statement questioning our integrity. He's referring to a letter Ford, Holmes, and West sent last April, implying that a campaign event park supporters had invited four pro-park commissioners to could be seen as pay to play. It was within this context that the commissioners filed into the North Carolina Museum of Art Saturday morning for their annual retreat, an event at which they set goals for the coming year. The Crooked Creek vote had sketched the outlines of factions, the ascendant Holmes and Ford leading the majority, Hutchinson and Calabria having seen their clout wane. But where Hutchinson has been visibly irritated, Calabria has opted to make peace with the new dynamic. He said he's trying to avoid personal attacks and is annoyed that he's been caught up in the back and forth. That doesn't mean I don't have my share of frustration, but I'm working hard to try and keep the lines of communication open among all commissioners. That's left Hutchinson on something of an island. In the first round of the retreat's goal-setting process, Hutchinson suggested changing the county's social and economic vitality priorities to focus on the health of the entire county rather than that of its most vulnerable populations. The majority wasn't having it. The rest of the day went much the same. While commissioners took up some of Hutchinson's suggestions, including implementing the results of the Population Health Task Force report, none became top priorities. He was clearly annoyed. At the meeting's conclusion, he was the only board member who didn't thank his colleagues. "I feel like some of my priorities were not held in priority," Hutchinson said. For the rest of the board, whatever tensions existed remained below the surface. The commissioners, all Democrats, prioritized developing a plan to support healthy mothers and babies, implementing a behavioral health plan, helping vulnerable populations in Southeast and Eastern Wake County, and expanding support for those released from prison as their top goals for 2019. They also want to create strategies to support minorities, women, people with disabilities, and families struggling financially, bring together municipalities and other stakeholders on issues pertaining to growth, sustainability, and zoning, to expand access to early childhood development programs, and work with the school board to establish a process for determining school funding. The county staff is tasked with creating policies to meet those goals. The board will further discuss its priorities at a workshop on February 11th and vote on them at its February 18th meeting. Holmes said she's pleased with how the retreat went. "We were all pleasantly surprised that everyone came to the table doing what we were elected to do," she said, "which is to put politics and personalities to the side for the benefit of our community." Whether the bonhomme exists when the next tough vote comes, that remains to be seen. "We have not healed," Hutchinson said. But then again, as he implicitly acknowledges, maybe he's just speaking for himself. "You know, if you are in the majority and voted for the park to be sold, I'm sure that you're fine with it." The next news article, Ears in the Sky. Durham might deploy audio sensors to listen for gunshots. Will they actually make the city safer? In the first 11 days of 2019, 6 people were shot and killed in Durham. There were 2 double homicides, including one whose victims were a young mother and her 10-month-old baby. Police considered 3 deadly incident cases of domestic violence. One man was found dead after a standoff with county deputies, his son charged with his murder. And in broad daylight, 2 teenage girls were struck by bullets fired by gang members shooting at each other from their vehicles, inflicting non-life-threatening injuries. Every time a person is shot in Durham, it rips a hole in a family. It rips a hole in a neighborhood. It rips a hole in a community, Durham Mayor Steve Shule said at a news conference. There were fewer gun crimes in 2018 than the 3 years prior, despite Durham's population growth. But these recent shootings have alarmed the community, kept officers working long hours, and caused elected officials to examine the city's approach to combating gun violence. It's against this backdrop that Durham officials, police, and sheriff's office representatives will get a pitch next week from a company called ShotSpotter to install its gunshot detection technology around the city. If the tech is installed, sensors placed throughout the city will listen for short, explosive sounds like gunshots. When the sensors are activated, an audio clip will be sent to machine, and in some cases, human reviewers to confirm whether the recording is actually of gunfire. If it is, local police will be dispatched to the scene. According to ShotSpotter, this all takes place within seconds. The goal is to get police to the scene faster, dispatch them to incidents that aren't reported to 911, and give them information on the kind of evidence, like the number of shots and caliber of the gun, to look for when they arrive. ShotSpotter boosts impressive results, saying the devices detect 90% plus of gunfire incidents with a precise location in less than 60 seconds. But questions have been raised over whether ShotSpotter actually helps reduce crime, and whether the sensors could be used to record more than rounds fired in the street. Developed in the 1990s from earthquake detection technology, ShotSpotter is in use in about 90 cities across the U.S., including Rocky Mount, Wilmington, Goldsboro, and Greenville in North Carolina. According to company spokeswoman Liz Einbinder, ShotSpotter sensors can detect gunshots up to a mile away. The devices don't have live audio streaming capabilities and are only activated when a gunshot-like sound is detected. The three closest sensors are then allowed to triangulate the exact location of the event within 82 feet, according to the company. The sensors, ideally installed 30 feet above the ground, most commonly on the tops of public and commercial buildings, can't detect gunfire indoors. City Councilmember Mark Anthony Middleton has been advocating for the city to consider ShotSpotter since 2015, when he saw it in action as a part of a local delegation that traveled to Boston. Middleton grew up in Brooklyn and remembers gunfire being so commonplace that neighbors stopped calling the cops. Sometimes, he said, what would happen is that when you get up the next morning, there's a body in the park because somebody actually did get shot. But because we had become so desensitized, people had stopped calling the police. While he wants to hear more from ShotSpotter and the community, he says that, given the level of gun violence in Durham, it would be irresponsible not to discuss the technology. City officials first considered installing ShotSpotter nearly 2 years ago, but didn't move forward because they worried about the expense. As city manager Thomas Bonfield explains, gun crimes aren't concentrated in one neighborhood, which means the city would need to install sensors across the city to be effective. The larger the coverage area, the higher the bill. In 2017, ShotSpotter crafted a pricing proposal covering parts of East Durham and areas around NC Central. According to the proposal, the city would pay a one-time $10,000 onboarding fee, $10,000 per square mile for installation, and an annual service fee of $65,000 per square mile. To cover the 3-square-mile area in East Durham outlined by the proposal, Durham would pay $235,000 for the first year. The city has been talking with North Carolina Central and Duke about splitting the cost, which wouldn't be unique. The city of Greenville is sharing its costs with East Carolina University, the local medical center, the sheriff's office, and the Public Housing Authority. It's expensive, but so are human lives, Middleton said. What price do you place on a Bull City resident's life? While working for the Atlanta Police Department, Durham Police Chief C.J. Davis worked with ShotSpotter representatives in Atlanta to assess its use, according to the Durham Police Department. Since her departure in 2016, Atlanta has implemented ShotSpotter. Davis declined an interview request. Other cities, Durham consultants say, the technology helped officers respond to more shootings faster, Bonfield said, but it hasn't always reduced the number of gun crimes. Everybody has confirmed that the system was very, very accurate, Bonfield said. There's no question about the accuracy. The question was, what's the result of getting there quicker? Sergeant Brad Summerlin of Rocky Mount Police Department says shot-fired incidences there have decreased by 60% since 2012, the first full year after the city became the first in North Carolina to adopt ShotSpotter. According to Summerlin, the technology is helping officers get guns off the street and arrest the people using them illegally, leading to a decline in gun crimes. While the sensors have picked up firecrackers and other loud noises, he said, those alerts get filtered out and, to his knowledge, officers have never been dispatched to a false alarm. That hasn't been the experience of all cities employing the technology. In 2016, Forbes obtained ShotSpotter data and found that, across seven cities, authorities dispatched by a ShotSpotter alert were unable to find evidence of gunshots when they arrived between 30 and 70% of the time. The majority of ShotSpotter alerts led to police closing the incidents with words such as unfounded, unable to locate, or gone on arrival. All those law enforcement jargon for, we didn't find anything. Outside of annual highlights, ShotSpotter doesn't share its data. Over the course of about a year and a half, Forbes reported, ShotSpotter devices in Wilmington produced 1,278 results. A third of the time, law enforcement didn't find evidence of a shooting, and only five arrests were made. In 2016, Charlotte decided ShotSpotter hadn't led to enough arrests to justify renewing an annual $163,000 contract. It's unclear why some officers dispatched by ShotSpotter alerts don't find evidence of a shooting, but it is clear that ShotSpotter, by design, sends cops to the neighborhoods being monitored by its sensors more often than they were before. And when they arrive, they're prepared to find a shooter. That could create tension in the communities that are already heavily policed, says State ACL spokeswoman Molly Rivera. We know that ShotSpotter, just like other surveillance technologies that are used by police, are used especially against communities of color, and it creates an oppressive and stigmatizing environment in which that community and the people who live within that community are treated like prospective criminals. They're going in expecting to find an active shooter, and entering a community like that creates a particular environment. Critics have also suggested that ShotSpotter could violate people's Fourth Amendment rights against unreasonable searches by recording dialogue, intentionally or not. While ShotSpotter sensors aren't activated by human voices, they have recorded people talking around gunfighter, including a few cases in which a victim's dying words have been captured and used to secure a conviction. Our technology and privacy policy allow us to provide only a few seconds of audio just before and after a gunshot, says Einbinder. If voices are concurrent with a gunshot and they are loud enough and close enough to a sensor, then they may be captured in the audio. But that is a very rare occurrence and far from a conversation. Jeff Welty, an associate professor of public law and government at UNC, says that while I don't think the question is completely settled, it's unlikely that the technology would rise to the level of a Fourth Amendment violation because these conversations are typically in outdoor public locations where courts may find there's no reasonable expectation of privacy. Well, there might not be specific privacy concerns with the technology itself. The real question is, well, what else can ShotSpotter do and how else can it be used? Asked State ACLU Communications Director Mike Minow. That raises questions like, are there going to be audio recordings? Are there going to be video recordings? What would trigger those recordings? Where in the city is it going to be used? Some cities have synced devices to activate video cameras when gunshots are detected. At least one, Boston, leak the sensors to ankle monitoring devices to check whether parolees are close to gunshots and might be violating their parole conditions. In October, ShotSpotter acquired the predictive policing tool HunchLab, which is offered as an addition. Bonfield said the city isn't currently considering syncing surveillance cameras with ShotSpotter. DPD analyst Jason Shai says the department already employs several tools to forecast where crimes may occur and has for the more than a decade. Meadows says if the city implements ShotSpotter, there needs to be a public process to determine where the sensors would be placed, how they would be used, and what policies would safeguard the technology from abuse. While the ShotSpotter has come to the city council meetings, the council hasn't yet discussed implementation, which it would have to approve via the annual budget. City and county leaders emphasized during last week's press conference that Durham won't eradicate gun violence without addressing its root causes, such as unemployment and the ability to enact local gun laws which state law preempts. Middleton says he knows ShotSpotter won't be a panacea, but the city could consider every tool at its disposal. Crime overall in Durham is down, but when a family member of years has been shot, that's not really a compelling argument to you, he said. That there's a tool we can avail ourselves of that can possibly save one life, I don't see how we cannot have a conversation about it. The next news article, we're having a governing crisis. Bob Woodward helped bring down Nixon. He says, you're right to be worried about Donald Trump. Very few journalists, living or dead, can credibly lay claim to having helped take down a president. Only one can do so and also say Robert Redford played him in a movie. Bob Woodward is, of course, a legend in the journalism world. His Watergate reporting with Carl Bernstein is required reading in J School, a masterpiece of sourcing and shoe leather that exposed the corruption at the highest levels of the Nixon administration. He's covered every president since, both in books and for the Washington Post, where he still works as an associate editor. His most recent book, Fear, Trump in the White House, based on thousands of pages of documents and hundreds of hours of interviews, offers an intimate and unsettling portrait of the chaos inside Donald Trump's administration. On February 2nd, Woodward will be at the Durham Performing Arts Center to talk about that book. Last week, staff writers Leah Taus and Sarah Willits asked him about Trump, Nixon, and the state of modern journalism. Sarah Willits began. Fear came out in September, and as you know, the news cycle out of this White House is nonstop. Since then, we've had more high-profile departures. We've had all this talk about the migrant caravan and the so-called crisis at the border, and most recently, the government shutdown. Is there anything that's happened since your book came out that you wish you could have included? Woodward said, people have said that so much of what's happening since September is like another chapter in the book. If you look at the book and my reporting on then-Secretary of Defense James Mattis, actually, what's in the book is an outline of Mattis' resignation letter in which he argued that we need allies, we need partnerships, and we can't do this alone. What I quote him in the book saying at this top-secret meeting is, look, we need to have these trade agreements. We need to have the military alliances and the top-secret intelligence partnerships. He said, that has done something important to this country to stabilize our position in the world. I'll say very directly to you, we have a governing crisis. Trump does not know how to govern, and he's got some ideas that are not based on facts. Leah Taus then, In your book, there's a sense that Trump is an unstable and erratic figure. Staff members are on an edge, tiptoeing around him, taking papers off his desk to stop him from signing them. I mean, are you concerned about the president's mental state? Woodward said, "Well, you know, I'm not a psychiatrist. What I'm concerned about is the governing, and the governing does not make sense and is too often against the interest of the country. I would argue Trump does things that are against his own interest." Whittington said, "What do you think has been the biggest misstory of the Trump presidency? What hasn't been covered enough?" Woodward replied, "I don't know. So much has been covered. We're going to find out, I guess, I hope, at some point, about the Mueller investigation. What do they have? They've got to have high-quality evidence to really lead to some sort of disruption of the presidency, or resignation, or impeachment and removal. And I don't know anyone who knows the answer to whether Mueller has that information. In the case of Nixon, we had thousands of hours of tapes which made the difference. Does Michael Cohen, who was Trump's personal lawyer for 10 years, who now has turned on Trump and pled guilty and is going to go to jail, does he have tape recordings or evidence that will explain actions or show criminality? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know anyone who does." Taus then went on, "One of the things that strikes me about your reporting on the Nixon administration is the intelligence and sophistication within that operation. A lot of times the Trump administration is depicted as kind of inept. What do you think are the similarities between what we're seeing in Trump and Nixon's administrations? And what do you think are the differences?" Woodward said, "Yeah, well, that's a great question. And my short answer is that it's easier to describe the creation of the universe. There are some similarities, and there are some differences. On the Russian collusion question, Watergate was a series of illegal, passive actions by Nixon and his people to make sure that Nixon was reelected. He was reelected in 72 by massive landslide. Is the Russian influence and the Russian role substantial enough and probable enough to show that this is why Trump got elected in 2016? I don't know the answer to that question, but that's an important one, and we'll see what the evidence is. But of course, this calls on us to do what we hate the most, and that is to be patient." Then from Willits, "Your reporting relies often on background sources. I wonder, in this climate of hostility toward the media, where a big point of criticism is the use of anonymous sources, how do you justify using anonymous sources to a country that's concerned about fake news?" Woodward said, "The country should be concerned about it. Happily, I have the luxury of time, and I can get notes and documents. If you read the book, you see that it will take you to specific moments or a specific place in the White House. And so, to the reader, it's not anonymous. It's very specific about what went on. It doesn't say where I got the information, but happily, it's so specific. And it's been so substantiated since the book came out that I know it's the best obtainable version of the truth. For instance, in the book, Trump's lawyer, John Dowd, worked with Trump intimately for 8 months. Big Trump supporter and believer. He did a practice session of Trump testifying to Mueller. They went through, and Dowd concluded that Trump can't tell the truth and makes things up. Dowd concludes at the end, though he won't say it to Trump's face, because he doesn't want to insult him. But he says, 'You're an effing liar,' and concludes that. Now, that's not Nancy Pelosi or some Democrat. That's the president's own lawyer." From Willits, "Having observed politics for as long as you have, I wonder what lessons you think the media should take from the 2016 campaign coverage and apply to 2020. Woodward said, "Dig in harder. Be more skeptical. But also be fair-minded and try to bleach out the emotional reaction to candidates. I think there's such an emotional reaction to Trump that it's been very difficult for journalists to step back. It's important. I've had lots of people read my book and say, 'Well, you're fair to Trump. You let him in.' It's a very critical book because of what he did in his decisions, and the tone is not an attack. And I think sometimes there is a lot of that, particularly on cable television, or praising him sometimes, like on Fox News, almost mindlessly." Taos, how would you describe your personal relationship with the president? I know that you didn't get to interview him for this book, Woodward. The title, Fear, comes from an interview Bob Costa, a reporter at the Post, and I did of Trump, in which we discussed power, of course. That's what the presidency is about, power, and the notion of what real power is. And that's where he says real power is. I don't like to use the word, but real power is fear. It's an almost a Shakespearean moment. Hamlet turning the audience saying, "This is what's going on. This is what it means." And when Trump said that, I was struck by the revelation about it. To scare people. And that's how you get and maintain real power. Willits, it's almost Machiavellian. How does that inform the way that you view his actions as president? Woodward, it actually turns out to be one of the things he does. He uses his power and scares people in lots of ways. Sometimes it may work, sometimes it may not. But that's his mode of operation. He also said in that interview, it was in early 2016, that he brings out rage in people, and he is almost proud of that. From Taos, one of the other things in the book that surprises me was Trump's emotional reaction to the realities of being the president. When he met with the parents of a soldier who had been killed overseas, when he saw the photos of children killed with sarin gas, it was a side of the president that I don't think many of us really sees. He was deeply affected by those things. How did that change the picture of him that you had in mind? Woodward, it doesn't change the picture, because you have to be empirical. Those things happened, and I reported them, and I thought it was part of the story. I thought it was central to the story. From Taos, before you worked at the Post, you got your start at a weekly. What do you think is the role of weekly papers in the current media landscape? Woodward, I love weekly newspapers. After I got out of college, I served 5 years in the Navy, and I was thinking of going to law school. I realized, gee, I'm going to be 30 when I get out of law school. And of course, at that age, you think 30 is the end of life, right? I tried to get a job at the Post. They gave me a 2-week tryout, which I failed. But I realized I love journalism, and I got a job at the Montgomery County Sentinel Weekly outside of Washington. I worked there for a year, and it was great. We had 4 reporters, and as you know, when you have a small staff, you learn to cover everything, or to try to cover everything, and it was a great training ground. From Taos, self-serving question. You've written 18 books. Do you ever get writer's block? Woodward laughed. He said, actually, this is the 19th. As you know, writing is hard, and you just have to get up and start, I always think. Get something down. See how it looks. See if you can make it better, if you can corroborate it. But writing is like anything. We are driven by habit, and I have the habit of doing a book and working on it and focusing on it. Willits, your appearance in Durham is on February 2nd. What should people expect? Woodward said, an outline and specifics about what's going on in the White House, about the psychology of Trump having been elected president with never holding public office or running for office before, and then what the questions are and what's on people's mind. I think that's critical. And Taos, so what's next after fear? Woodward said, you know, maybe another Trump book? I'm not sure. What do you think? Our next article, are you a feminist? We asked men in the Triangle about rape culture, toxic masculinity, and gender inequality. You might be surprised at what they had to say. In the United States, 1 in 5 women will experience a rape or attempted rape in their lifetime. In 80% of those assaults, the victim will know the assailant. 1 in 4 girls will be sexually abused before she turns 18. A woman in this country is beaten every 9 seconds. And of course, women still earn about 80% of what men make in the workplace. Next year will mark the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which guaranteed women the right to vote. Yet no woman has ascended to the White House, though one did receive more votes than any white man ever has. Instead, the current resident at the Oval Office famously boasted about grabbing women by their intimate anatomy. Those comments were brushed aside as locker room talk by politicians and preachers who saw in Donald Trump a chance to reshape the federal courts to deny women the right to control their own bodies. Last year, they got what they wanted. An anti-abortion Supreme Court justice who'd been credibly accused of sexual assault but was rammed through the Senate as a middle finger to the hashtag MeToo movement. The problem isn't just Trump. It's the culture that enabled him. A toxic masculinity that shames victims, deems ambitious women unlikable, and even whose cartoons teach little girls to think of themselves as hypersexualized objects. But Trump's election also awakened something, a wave of resurgent, unapologetic feminism determined to fight an old patriarchy that was desperate to maintain control. This new energy found a home in the women's marches in January of 2017 and 18, in which millions of women all over the globe took to the streets to demand respect and equal rights. It has also lent support to the hashtag MeToo movement and formed the foundation of November's Blue Wave that thoroughly repudiated Trump. At 1 p.m. Saturday, the thousands of women and men will gather in Halifax Mall for the 3rd annual Women's March in Raleigh. While the National Women's March has been dogged by allegations of anti-Semitism and LGBTQ exclusion, the local group isn't affiliated with that. Ahead of that event, I wanted to explore what feminism means today. More specifically, I wanted to find out what feminism means to men. What comes to mind when they think of the words feminism and toxic masculinity? How do they negotiate rape culture and what they taught about consent? Do they believe our society is still fundamentally unequal and patriarchal? The truth is, women need men to achieve equality, and equality is only possible when there are understanding and respect between the genders. Over the last few months, I conducted dozens of interviews with men in the Triangle, asking a series of questions about feminism and related issues, an exercise designed to help me better understand their perceptions of the roles they play and to raise their awareness of inequality. I've collected some of the responses here, edited for space and clarity. To ensure candor, I'm using only their first names. I found many of their answers surprisingly aware. If they weren't well informed, they were at least willing to listen and learn. But I also came away thinking that we don't talk about this stuff nearly enough, that we as a community need to have more authentic conversations about what feminism and gender equality really mean, and that we as parents, perhaps along with sex-positive educators, need to have more forthright conversations with our kids about consent. Here are some of those interviews. First with Matt, age 35, a director of operations. Are you a feminist? I guess it depends on your definition. Do I support women's rights? Well, absolutely. Do you believe we live in an unequal patriarchal society? I wouldn't say that it's unequal. I would say that there are certain segments of society and industries that have a bias either toward or against women. But I don't think as a whole we are a biased patriarchal system. No. Do you think women should be paid as much as men? Well, absolutely. All things being equal, if you're working hard, skill set for skill set, absolutely. Do you think the government should require equal pay? You know, I don't know about the law because that becomes legal mumbo-jumbo. I don't know about laws, but there's definitely should be guidance within organizational policies that say that. I think some companies are getting there, but there's probably a long way to go. Have you ever witnessed a sexual assault? Not to my knowledge. You know, actually, I'm going to retract that. Based on now what I understand sexual assault to be, yes. And I understand the severity of it. Yes. If you asked me this question 10 years ago, I would have said no to the same set of circumstances. But I think now, having a much better understanding, being more mature, being more aware, actually, yes. So I assume it was hard at the time to do anything to prevent it. So, yeah, I mean, it was. You mean it was things that, you know, a 24-year-old and, you know, obviously living in a very different time where issues weren't as broad. You don't read stories on Instagram and social media. People weren't coming out about being where an incident happened. There was nothing out there to really make you think about the implications of what at the time was considered he was drunk or she was drunk, whatever the case may be. But whatever it was, you know, just an inappropriate, you know, kiss on the cheek or gesture with a hand and not necessarily anything that's completely egregious where, you know, somebody is going to get arrested but still unwanted, which I think is the key term, right? You know, I think sexual assault these days is, as it should be, defined as any unwanted verbal or physical gesture toward another person. And that's not something I would have recognized 10 years ago. To have a look back? Absolutely. But no, I think at the time, I probably didn't realize it. What does feminism mean to you? Well, I think, unfortunately, in today's society, it's taken on a negative connotation. People look at it as a bad thing, that it's the female population to try and take advantage of a certain set of rules or regulations or policies. I don't think that at all. Feminine is really, in a nutshell, equality for women that you should have had to be arguing, shouldn't have to have been arguing for. But you know, unfortunately, we have a history that puts us in a position where we have to argue for it. And I think in my lifetime, it no longer will have to be a discussion you'll have on purpose. It will be something that happens by the course of nature. I hope. Now with Pete, age 47, a police officer. Are you a feminist? I don't consider myself a feminist by label, no. I mean, I'm an equalist. That's a term I just made up myself. I work in a very male-dominated profession, however. I love to see anyone who is qualified to do the job standing alongside me. And that person, of course, should be paid the same amount of money as me, as long as we are both qualified, whether they're female or male, or whether they don't identify as either. So whether I'm a feminist or not, I don't know. I am a humanist. I'm an equalist. What does feminism mean to you? I think feminism is sort of morphed. Unfortunately, the popular opinion, and this is not my opinion, the popular opinion of feminism is a bunch of angry, men-hating women who generally don't have a concern about equality, but more superiority. Now a conversation with Brandon, age 19, a food truck operator. Have you ever heard the term toxic masculinity? He said, yeah. It's a way that lots of men were raised to suppress their emotions, to suppress their feelings, based on societal norms. And it manifests itself into this masculine toxic energy. Have you ever heard a sexist comment or a joke, then felt pressure to laugh or keep quiet? Yeah, not to laugh, but keep quiet. Because I felt like it's not in my place to speak up for someone because I'm not in the marginalized group. But I'm starting to feel more comfortable with speaking up for people who are being oppressed because I wish that someone would have done the same for me. Did your parents ever talk to you about sex and consent? They gave me a really halfway conversation about sex and consent. It didn't really pertain to how that applies to gay men. Then with Ethan, age 27, a grant writer. Do you think we live in a patriarchal society? Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about this. It's profoundly patriarchal and racist. What do you think about pornographic films that depict violence and domination over women? I read a fair amount of academic literature on pornography, and I would say that some of it is definitely violently misogynistic, and a lot of it is really neither sexist nor progressive. A lot of it is pretty milquetoast. I think there's definitely sexist, violent pornography out there. Definitely not something that interests me. Do you think strip clubs are sexist? You know, I really don't know. Again, there are issues of the economy of it and issues of economic power. But I could maybe imagine some weird sort of progressive stripping in a less profoundly sexist patriarchal society. But like everything in the U.S., there is an element of sexism to it. Do you think prostitution is sexist? Not necessarily, because I think anyone can participate in sex work. It's not innately sexist, even if there are serious economic power imbalances. Now with Bill, age 37, a contractor. Have you ever heard the term rape culture? Yes, when I hear it, I think of, you know, fraternal college behavior and the group mindset of men that just, you know, laugh off unwanted sexual advances. In their mind, it's harmless, but it's unwanted sexual advances, so it's not harmless. Have you ever heard a sexist comment or joke and felt pressured to laugh or keep quiet? Oh, sure, yeah. I have a few different circles of friends, one of which is, you know, on the golf course. It's a wide range of backgrounds of people that hang out together, and there are certainly like jokes at the expense of women. Have you ever witnessed a sexual assault? No, I didn't. I mean, I've witnessed a good number of unwanted sexual advances, like in college, but never an assault. Did you try to prevent those incidences? I don't think I did in every instance, because again, I'm going back to your question about rape culture. You know, it was in the minds of, like, buddies or whomever I was with who were doing that, and they thought they were just having fun. And, you know, it was harmless. But I could tell it was making, you know, the woman in this example uncomfortable. You know, just leave it alone. What does feminism mean to you? For some of the people I know, they might cringe just at the word of feminism. And I think that's one of the biggest issues with it, because it really is just simply a matter of, like, women need to be equals in the society, and at this point, they simply are not. Would you say that you are a feminist? By definition, yes, I'm a feminist, but not an activist. Then with Jeff, age 41, a criminal defense attorney. Are you a feminist? I don't know what that is. Would you agree that we live in an unequal patriarchal society? Yes. Do you think women should be paid as much as men? Yes. Do you think the government should make laws requiring equal pay? No. Have you ever gone to a women's march? No. Never been invited. Now with Phil, age 71, retired. Are you a feminist? Give me your definition of feminism. Someone who believes in equal rights. All right, absolutely, then yes, I am. What does feminism mean to you? In life, if I met some girls that I considered feministic, the more it would have brought me out the gentleman in me. Would you agree that we live in an unequal patriarchal society? Well, I think it's getting better. Men are probably not used to women getting the same rights as they have or the way they are being treated, but I think it's getting better. Now with Steve, age 38, an educator. What does feminism mean to you? My interpretation of being feminist would be someone that is committed spiritually, personally, religiously, everything they do to promote, champion, advocate, embrace, engender rights for all. Do you think the government should make laws requiring equal pay? I do think there need to be interventions by institutions, and I'm learning more and more the dynamics about the way that local and national governments play. But we need some way to intervene and break the momentum of the decades, of the centuries of bias that we had in our society. So, yes. Have you ever witnessed a sexual assault? My initial instinct is to say no. But given some things in the news the last couple of months, I'd really like to go back in my memory banks and see. I've been unfortunate to really have had good role models, and I think I was taught some good values. I don't know if I was naive, and maybe the things I saw, definitely in high school and college. Yeah, I'm sure there were a lot of what I would call unclear behaviors at that point in my life. And again, I wouldn't have counted them at the time as sexual assault, maybe because of my own naivety. But it's probably a good exercise for me to go back, because there was a lot of drinking. I didn't see people engaged in acts, but I saw what I would hope would be consensual acts. I was out and around a lot of things that were more like what people will call a hookup culture, you know, in college. And so I don't know that I can honestly say no now. Did your parents ever talk to you about sex and consent? I think they did. I was such a dorky kid, and I remember this idea of love and sex was supposed to be between married people who love each other. I know I would never do anything to someone without their consent. I was raised to respect people. I don't think they ever talked about, like, if you're ever going to have sex with someone, because it was never presented as an option. It was more like, this is something sacred that you should hold dear. I don't think that that was the part of the way they would describe it, and so that's interesting that you'd ask about sex and consent together, because as a parent now, I would absolutely include that in my talk to my children. Now with Charles, age 32, a manager. Would you agree that we live in an unequal patriarchal society? Well, yes and no. I wouldn't say that it's a blanket statement that we are in an unequal patriarchal society. I would definitely say that there's a ton of inequity for women in the marketplace and in tech. The numbers show it. So I will say yes and no. Do you think women should be paid as much as men? Of course. Do you think the government should make laws requiring equal pay? Anytime the government gets involved with things such as equal pay and things like that, I think as long as we have the right people at the table and it's not a top-down approach, I think that's what really gets us into a lot of hot water, especially when it comes to equity. We typically have a top-down approach. What's your position on abortion? I have two ways to think about that. One is women arguing for the right to choose where they keep the baby or not. And on the pro-life side, if women are not given the right to choose, then there needs to be people, not just money, willing to step up to raise that child. Particularly, me being an African-American man, and also being a part of an underdeveloped, economically fragmented community of color, where there are too many babies being born into really tough situations. Even though they are not now aborted, they're pretty much aborted into the system and left to die or left to be incarcerated. And then Ben 38, a massage therapist and cycling coach. Have you ever heard the term toxic masculinity? I'm sure I've heard it. I think it's an expectation that men are to behave a certain way to their own, in lots of cases, to their own detriment as well as a societal detriment. Something that leads to certain expectations in the male culture, like, you know, when you're supposed to have sex and how you should feel about women and how you should talk about women. What do you think about the pornographic films that depict violence and domination over women? I think there's some stuff out there that's pretty awful. I think that the problem is that the path that it leads us down is that the young men, who are probably the ones predominantly watching it, think that stuff is appropriate and the right way to engage in sexual relationship. So it changes how we interact in a very negative way. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.